Hello and welcome to Fidelity Connects, the Fidelity Investments Canada podcast. Proudly ranked the number one podcast by Canadian financial advisors in the 2021 Environics Advisor Digital Experience Study. Joining us today to speak about using Fidelity's resources and strength to uncover opportunities in value investing and dividend investing are portfolio managers Joel Tillinghast and Ramona Prasad. For Canadian investors, Joel manages Fidelity Global Intrinsic Value Class alongside Salim Hart, Fidelity North Star Fund alongside Dan DuPont and Kyle Weaver, and Fidelity Global Growth and Value Class alongside Will Danoff. Joel first joined Fidelity in 1986 and now serves as a mentor for the next generation of investors. Host Pat Balland asks Ramona for her perspectives on the role Joel has played for her and others both in the office and during COVID's work from home. Ramona is a dividend investor who has been with Fidelity since 2003. For Canadians, she manages U.S. Dividend Fund in addition to several private pools and sub-portfolio manager responsibilities on many multi-asset funds, including Global Monthly Income Fund. Both Joel and Ramona share their investment approaches and principles, reflecting on their current portfolio positionings, share where they are finding opportunities, and share their perspectives on the current market environment. Pat also asks their opinions on different sectors' valuations, U.S. politics affecting the markets, and the value versus growth discussion. Today's podcast was recorded on September 29th, 2021, as a session during our recent Access 2021 digital event. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of Fidelity Investments Canada ULC or its affiliates. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be construed as investment, tax, or legal advice. It is not an offer to sell or buy, or an endorsement, recommendation, or sponsorship of any entity or security cited. Read a fund's prospectus before investing. Funds are not guaranteed. Their values change frequently, and past performance may not be repeated. Fees, expenses, and commissions are all associated with fund investments.
Good morning, Joel. Good morning, Ramona.
Good morning, Pat.
Great to see you guys, sort of, distance. When I look at the two of you,
I think of
value investing. I think of quality investing. I think of global investing. So Joel, I'm going to start with you, and Ramona, I'm going to get to you in a second. Do those characterize your investment style, and what do you think of how the market is right now?
Yeah, those definitely do describe my investment style. I guess there are three big approaches to investing, ways that people can get an edge. One is to invest in companies where profits are getting much better right now, sort of a momentum approach. And I do some of this, but it's not my focus. A second approach is to look for companies where you have well above average 3 to 5 year earnings growth that's well-defined, and I do some of this approach. A third approach, which is my focus, is to compare price with value. And obviously, if a company is growing well, then it will get higher valuation measures. And I think that if you cast a wide net in what you're looking for value, you will produce better results. If you look at 10 stocks and one of them is an amazing buy, then if you look at 100 stocks, you'll have 10 amazing buys, and you can do more of that with international investing.
And Ramona, you add in the element not only of the value and quality and global, but also dividends. So talk to me about the role of dividends as well.
Sure. So I definitely like value, as Joel just talked about. And if you're able to combine value with income, you can get pretty good, certainly risk-sensitive, risk-adjusted returns over time. So dividends, why are they interesting? Why are they important? They make up a big part of total return over time. So going back in history, dividends are actually 40% of total return over time, which is pretty high, obviously higher in down markets because the dividend is always positive. And what's great about the dividend is that it's your current income. So you can get some of that total return today in the form of dividends, so a big part of total return. And then dividend companies, companies that pay dividends, tend to be high quality companies, high returning companies with a lot of predictability and stability, which means that in down markets, your dividend will really, your dividend paying companies can really protect your downside. And what that also means, those quality companies often have pricing power, so they can price above inflation. So if you're concerned about inflation, as a lot of people are now, you have an opportunity with dividend paying stocks to get real growth in your cash flows from your real pricing, meaning cash flow growth above inflation and therefore dividend growth above inflation. I also really like dividends because they tend to be a volatility dampener. So because of that quality and downside protection feature, if you've got enough dividends in your total return stream, you can really dampen the volatility of your overall total return, which does wonders for your risk-adjusted returns, such as information ratio and Sharpe ratio.
Okay, so now I need some ideas. I need to see where the opportunities are. I'll go back to Joel, I guess, to start with. Where do you see the best opportunities right now, Joel, whether it's in region or sector or factor? You tell me where you think there might be opportunity. Because, you know, in the past, what we've seen from your portfolios, for instance, Joel, is you've had an interest on a regional basis, at least, in Japan. And we've seen a lot of small cap companies in Japan that have obviously served you very well over the course of time. So I'd love your thoughts, obviously, following up on Japan, but other regions of the world.
Still love small cap Japan. Japan has about as many public companies as the United States, even though it is about 3/8 the population. So lots of companies. And you know, there are lots of growing, profitable companies, low PEs, with great balance sheets and a special niche. So it's happy hunting ground, and I have to give a thumbs up to people like Sam Chamovitz, who's supported me in, you know, finding these great stocks, as well as many analysts. I also think that there's an opportunity in healthcare, public health especially. I think COVID has reshaped the world, and the public health will be an area of continuing importance. We have low interest rates, and with people cooped up at home, the whole housing value chain is interesting. And so I'm finding lots of stocks there.
Okay. And over to you. Yeah. Oh, sorry, Joel, go ahead.
The internet has, or the epidemic has forced a lot of unexpected innovation. I'm looking at retailers, but other businesses that have change their business model for the better because they were forced to. During the about March last year, I talked to a home builder, and they had sold a house to people totally virtually. The buyer had gone on a virtual tour, and they had done the closing, and this was totally new. So I'm looking for companies that are adapting well with forced innovation.
Yeah, I don't think I'd be on that list of viewing a house and buying it sight unseen, but you're absolutely right. Technology does have a role these days, doesn't it? Ramona, sorry.
No problem. Joel has much more interesting stuff to say than I do, so it's important for him to finish. So what's been interesting to me lately, and playing off of what Joel said, the most fun part of the job is finding ideas far all across the world that not everyone is looking at. So I actually learned from Joel that small cap Japan is really interesting, and we have an incredible team based in Tokyo that helps us to hone in on those ideas. Right now, what I find more interesting is pandemic recovery ideas outside of the US. So a lot of the U.S. market has very much discounted the emergence from pandemic, but in parts of continental Europe and emerging markets, there's still a lot of skepticism about what coming out of the pandemic will look like. So I'll give you an example. There's a travel retailer in the United Kingdom. It was founded in the 1700s, which is a long time ago, and it's a really high quality company. So think of when you go to an airport and you're buying your magazines and your snacks and all the things you think you need for travel. Obviously, that business has been decimated because people aren't traveling. It's still at a very reasonable valuation, very strong management. The historical ROE, so return on equity, is somewhere between 30 and 40%, very good return on incremental capital. So all of the things we look for in a quality company, good cash flow generation, and I can still buy that at a reasonable multiple. So there's still many ideas like that outside of the US, and that's where I've been spending a lot of my time.
Yeah, and you've always had an interesting portfolio looking at names I'd never seen before. So thank you, Ramona. You know, it's interesting, Joel. I have your book. Thank you very much for that copy of that book. And Joel, when I look at your principles, and you have five principles in investing, what happens when markets don't necessarily follow your principles? Walk me through each one of them, because the first one has to do with being a rational investor, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's knowing what you're good at and where you're bad and trying to make decisions rationally. And I know that I'm not very good at decisions about what's getting much better now. I tend to be late to the party and only bail out when I try to do that. So I don't do it, whereas I think I am good at comparing price with value, and I'm not bad at thinking about where will a company be in 3 to 5 years. Problem is, all of these approaches have periods where they work great, and they have periods where they don't work. And you have to think about, what am I missing? What can I learn from the approaches that are working? So the momentum approach would pull up the thought that maybe the pandemic has changed a lot of things. And so it's changed the 3 to 5 year trajectory of growth. And so I try to rationally adapt to that and say, well, I was wrong. And knowing where you're bad is the toughest part of making decisions rationally.
Yeah, another principle I find is interesting, and it goes back to Peter Lynch, really, at Fidelity, is invest in what you know. And as you're pointing out, it's always a learning experience. The pandemic has obviously forced that a lot on people. But walk me through the rest of the principles, not only what you know, but also honest companies, if you will.
Yeah, I would love to invest in cutting edge technologies or biotechs that are going to save people's lives, but figuring out which drugs are going to get through phase 1, 2, 3 and get approval and then be a success in the market, I have no edge there. Cutting edge technologies, it's also path dependent, and I know so little about the future of technology that, I don't know that. So I tend to prefer simpler businesses that have a baseline where I can say, this is what this company does that's really special. If there's nothing that's special, then I don't want to do it. But there's also the third principle is invest with honest and capable executives. And I hope that Ramona and I are honest and capable, but the companies that we're looking for, if value is the present value of future cash flows, then a lot is standing on decisions that corporate executives are going to make in the future. And there's a whole art to figuring that out. The fourth principle is invest in resilient businesses that are not too cyclical, where they won't be destroyed by competition. I want businesses that are doing something special and unique. And a fifth principle is don't overpay. It's the basic part of the value investing creed.
Yeah, and indeed, Ramona, I mean, you play into that value space as well. But I'm curious, over the last decade, value hasn't worked as well as growth, for instance. I'd love your perspective on why that is.
Sure. There have been two sort of big macro themes I would point to. One is what we call globalization. And the second, not unrelated, is a sort of structural decline in interest rates. So globalization just essentially opened up these big pools of much cheaper labor to the entire world, and certainly to the developed world that has much more expensive labor, which meant that you could really bring the capital intensity of your business down. So capital intensity overall came down, which meant profitability went up, free cash flow generation went up, and the gap in profitability between capital intensive businesses and what we call capital light businesses widened out in favor of capital light businesses. So your traditional value sectors like financials, industrials, materials, energy, they ended up not looking as good in this world as some of the more capital light businesses that could just really get a lot more or less capital intensive, if you will. So in my mind, that was a huge contributing factor to value not doing as well, just capital intensity overall coming down. And then the structural decline in interest rates sort of makes cash flows that are far out in the future be more valuable today. And so that really benefits sort of the more growth-oriented company. So those two factors together, I think, really were a headwind to value. That didn't mean, though, that you couldn't be a successful value investor. I think you had to really differentiate between your capital-intensive value and your capital-light value and understand that dynamic between the two.
We are getting some questions, Joel and Ramona, from the audience. And the first one we've got is actually kind of stripped from the headlines. Are you worried about the various U.S. political issues, debt ceiling, for instance, is one that we're hearing, which have been come to a head this week? I don't know who wants to tackle debt ceiling or politics. Go ahead.
I have no edge in on the debt ceiling, but this is why Ramona and I try to take a long term, why it's good to have dividends that are going to give you a total return now and in the near future, because you just don't know. I don't know any more than you do.
Yeah, fair enough.
Ramona?
I agree with Joel. I think you have to, this comes through clearly in his book. You have to really understand what you know and what you don't know, and maybe accept that you know less than what you know, and stick to what you know. So one of the things I learned most from Joel is the role of valuation. So when stocks and markets discount something really negative so much, then you can actually take a view, right? So if markets get cheap enough, which they're not necessarily today, then you can say something big and scary like debt ceiling or a host of other things are overly discounted in the market. So I try to just have valuation lead the way.
You bring up an interesting point, though, and Joel, I don't want to embarrass you, but I mean, Ramona, Joel's been such an influence on a whole generation of investors. I'd love to hear your perspective on the role he's played with you, both in your investing style, but even at the office.
Sure. So, but Joel, you know this because I tell you this. I believe if you have something good to say, you should say it. So I'll maybe take it back to one of the things that comes through in Joel's speaking and his writing is this idea that everyone, the typical person is attracted to glamour. We're attracted to things that are comfortable. There's a line in the book that I can't quote now that summarizes this really well. We're attracted to the things that make us feel good. And effective investing actually benefits discomfort. So if you can find comfort with discomfort, I think you say there's shadow. Do you remember the line? There's shadow income in boredom and patience and essentially discomfort. That really resonates with me. And it was so incredible to find an investor in my world when I was starting who for whom that was their principle, because that just really resonated with me. Joel also obviously really exemplifies valuation, the role of valuation, and things that are less obvious, like the role of low turnover, and more abstractly, the role of incredible patience. So those are the things I've learned in my almost 20 years of being kind of fortunate to learn by being in the same space.
And more than just the same space, as I understand it, you guys often have coffee together. But that's a little bit difficult through COVID. How have you actually kept in touch? Or have you? Tea? Oh, is it tea? How have you kept in touch through the pandemic, for instance? Do you guys call each other?
We have regular Zoom chats to talk about life and culture as well as investments.
Yep, we used to spontaneously run into each other in the kitchen making tea, and would just end up talking about lots of things, obviously investing, but to my positive surprise, all kinds of other things that are more life-oriented. And I missed that when the pandemic started, so we decided to just kind of like try to recreate that by Zoom. So we meet every so often regularly on Zoom, sometimes with tea, without tea. And so we talk, work, but we also talk about how to make the culture better. We talk about things like burnout, because everyone is feeling a measure of burnout and how to improve upon that, what we can do, what we have control of that we can do for the culture. We talk about things like diversity and inclusion, how to get better at having high potential candidates who are not obvious, having them get seen so that we can continue to develop talent in the organization, all kinds of things like that. And to me, those have been as profound, if not more profound, than the investing talks.
The whole concept of teamwork, I guess, as much as anything else. We do have another question from the audience. Can you talk about sectors that you're concerned are overvalued? Wow, that's all encompassing. They're probably not sectors that you're investing in, but I don't know.
Most future-oriented part of technology is where my worries are most concentrated, as well as some of the most future-oriented parts of health technology.
Okay. Ramona, do you have areas, sectors that you're concerned about?
So, yeah, put a different way. The stuff that benefits from interest rates staying very, very low or distortedly low forever, so that would be your high growers, just are not interesting yet. And then more normal stuff like discretionary got expensive earlier this year. So I had added a lot to those in the last year and brought that down. Value as a factor was really cheap 18 months ago, obviously, and continue to be cheap in spaces and then throughout the year, and then cheap again going into the U.S. election last year. And now value as a factor is not quite as cheap. So I'm sort of waiting for that to become more interestingly valued. So financials, industrial, some parts of materials, I would like to be a little bit cheaper.
Joel, you know, we're speaking to a Canadian audience, and I know you had strong opinions earlier this year on energy. I'd love to get those freshened up. What are your thoughts on energy right now, especially in light of what's happening with carbon reduction and geopolitics?
I think energy transition is inevitable. Even if climate change is not inevitable, I think the pressures to do something about it will continue. And so I'm trying to focus on companies that can live with energy transition. Some of that is bigger oil companies like Total in France that are investing in alternative energies. Some of it is trying to tilt towards less lower carbon footprints. So companies that make natural gas have a smaller carbon footprint than oil, which has a smaller carbon footprint than coal. So trying to do that. I think energy demand is going to continue to increase. And if you look at the developing world, they have much lower energy consumption. And I'm hoping that someday their standard of living can match the developed world. So I'm focusing on India and Asian energy opportunities, but also on trying to adapt to climate change.
Ramona, we only have a minute and a half left, but I'd love your thoughts on tech, because you and I have discussed this in the past, and I think the kind of the phraseology, and I'll paraphrase it, it's kind of a winner tech all kind of a thing, whether it's Facebook becomes huge. I'd love your opinion on tech and whether you have any or much, or whether it's something you stay away from.
So tech can be segmented in a couple of different ways. One way we think about it is sort of high growth, winner take all tech, and another. And so the alternative to that is legacy tech. I tend to end up in legacy tech. So mature companies that are past their fastest growing phase, that are generating a lot of free cash flow, and you can still win in those. So the trick is, like, we keep coming back to valuation. You wait for them to get cheap enough. So the story I like to tell that's easy to understand is maybe 10 years ago, Joel, Microsoft got to a single digit multiple of earnings because the market was overly discounting how fast their cash flow generation would fade. And the market was basically treating them as if the cash flow was going to end much sooner than it did. And in fact, it didn't end. They managed to rejuvenate it with Azure and their cloud business. Enterprise was not as bad as expected. So if you can buy slower growth tech with great free cash flow when the market thinks the free cash flow is going to hit a wall, that's how value people can make money in tech.
Wow.
So I do own some of it. I own tech.
And the home run happens if you've got a new business that you're not paying for, like Azure. But
just
I didn't stay around for that either.
We'll remember that one. Last question, because we're running out a little bit of time. Are you concerned about the potential contagion effect on the global economy of the Chinese company Evergrande? Well, that's obviously in the headlines as well.
A lot of what Ramona and I do is trying to take out the tail risk. And I think we have companies that have better than average balance sheets, that have steadier than average businesses. And so if there's a contagion effect, it will pop up just where you don't expect it. But I think we have more resilient companies. And yeah.
So the stuff I own in China is like alcohol, which is actually a staple. So those stocks have been doing really well when the market have, you know, relatively when the market has started to really worry about China. So as Joel said, I will tend to go look for the stable stuff, the boring, unglamorous stuff. And it's in times like these that they shine. So that's the essence of the approach.
I dare say with that company having the problems, maybe alcohol will do better. We'll see.
Yeah, I have drug distributors and diapers in China. So,
you got all the bases covered. Joel, Ramona, as always, a pleasure to talk to both of you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Pat.
Thanks for listening to the Fidelity Connects podcast. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe to Fidelity Connects on your podcast platform of choice. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a review or a 5-star rating. You can visit fidelity.ca for more information on future live webcasts, and don't forget to follow Fidelity Canada on Twitter. Thank you. See you tomorrow.